Well, in chapter 19, Jehoshaphat limps back into Jerusalem after the disaster of the previous chapter. And Micaiah's words are ringing in his ears, and he's still shaking from his close encounter with death. And then in chapter 19, verse 1, Jehoshaphat the king returns to his house in peace. And Jehu, the son of Hananiah the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, this is the title of our class, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord." And notice the play on words that Jehu uses here. The word love there is the word Ahab. Ahab means love. So he's saying, Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and Ahab, them that hate Yahweh? Ahab. He's kind of taking his mind back there. Now, when did we last read of Hanani the seer? Well, that was, again, back in chapter 16. And we went back there again in our last class at how Hanani the seer, in chapter 16, verse 7, again, Hanani the seer comes out and rebukes Asa for relying on the king of Syria. And then in verse 10, Asa was wroth with the seer and put him in a prison house because he was in a rage with him. So that was Asa's undoing. When he was rebuked by Hanani, well, he couldn't take it. He responded, like we saw in our last class, Ahab and Asa did the exact same thing. They threw the prophet who rebuked them into prison. So what's Jehoshaphat going to do? Because it's really a deja vu all over again, isn't it? You had Hanani rebuked Asa, and then Hanani's son, Jehu, rebukes Asa's son, Jehoshaphat. So it's the family connection going on. Two sons acting out the exact same situation as their fathers. So is Jehoshaphat going to show pride and wrath like his father Ahab or Asa, and as Ahab did? Well, no, he doesn't. And this is, again, in the back of your notes somewhere, there is a chart on the similarities and the differences between Asa and Jehoshaphat. You don't have to look at it now, just for your knowledge. And that's probably the main difference between these two men, is their ability to respond to rebuke. And look at verse 3 of chapter 18 then, or chapter 19, sorry. Nevertheless, and that was a very important word in the life of Jehoshaphat, nevertheless, despite of this huge mistake that you made, nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, in that thou hast taken away the groves out of the land and hast prepared thine heart to seek God. And that's our little word, derash, again. And Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again through the people from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim. And notice this phrase, he brought them back unto Yahweh, God of their fathers. Now, keep a marker here, but go back to the book of Numbers. Because that phraseology, brought them back, is straight out of Numbers chapter 27. Now, Numbers chapter 27 is dealing with the appointment of Joshua as the successor to Moses. And this is where this terminology comes. Look at Numbers chapter 27, verse 16. Moses says to the people, "Let Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, which may go out before them, and which may go in before them, and which may lead them out, and which may bring them in. That the congregation of Yahweh," and notice this phrase, "be not as sheep which have no shepherd." Well, that's what Micaiah had said was going to happen. He said, if you go out, Ahab, you're going to die, and Israel's going to be like sheep that have no shepherd. So Jehoshaphat is going to bring the people back in like a shepherd was supposed to do. He's not going to be like Ahab. He's not going to allow Judah to be scattered on the mountains like sheep with no shepherd. He's going to be the good shepherd. He's going to bring them back in. So he's really learning, isn't he? Bringing the flock of Judah back to their God. And we start seeing Jehoshaphat sounds a little more like the Jehoshaphat of chapter 17, doesn't he? And less like the different Jehoshaphat who showed up in our last chapter. He's going to be a shepherd. Now, you can tell by the response of Jehoshaphat, he's a lot like the man spoken up in Proverbs chapter 9, verse 8 and 9. And Solomon tells us in Proverbs 9, verse 8, "Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee." That's actually the word Ahab again. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? "Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning." So that's a significant difference between Asa and Jehoshaphat, isn't it? Asa was rebuked and chucked the man into prison. Jehoshaphat listens, humbles himself, and responds by being wiser and increasing in learning. So, how would we respond if a prophet of God came up to us and publicly rebuked us? Or what about a friend rebukes us? Or an elder? Or more likely, our parents rebuke us or tell us off a little bit? Because the way we respond is often a measure of our spirituality. Are we going to respond like Asa and Ahab? Or are we going to respond like Jehoshaphat? The response of Asa and Ahab shows spiritual weakness and pride. But the response of Jehoshaphat shows humility and spiritual strength. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend," we read of in the Proverbs. Now, as we mentioned, there's a lot of positive attributes of Jehoshaphat's character, but kind of hinted at this last class, there's one chronic weakness that Jehoshaphat had to deal with, and that was his habit of making foolish alliances. Now, as you can see in your notes, we already looked at the marriage alliance in chapter 18, verse 1. We looked at the military alliance with Ahab in the battle against Syria, also in chapter 18, verse 3. We won't look at it this weekend, but in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 35, there's a shipbuilding partnership that Jehoshaphat enters with Ahab's son Ahaziah, who is described as doing very wickedly. And God does not approve, and God sees that the ships are wrecked before they get sent out on their way to Tarshish. But that was a financial enterprise he entered. And then there's another military alliance he engages in 2 Kings chapter 3 with Joram, another of Ahab's sons, again against Moab. Now, Jehoshaphat should have known better. He made two huge mistakes in chapter 18, and he keeps doing it. So it's suggestive that this is an area of his character which just wasn't strong enough. And Jehoshaphat, as well as each of us, have to be really thankful that God doesn't give up on us after our first or second or third or fourth mistake. And if we respond like Jehoshaphat does, where he comes back to Jerusalem, he humbles himself, he addresses the sins and turns his back on them, then God can forgive us. He can remove our sins as far as the east is from the west, as Psalm 103 tells us, right? If you go back to Psalm 34, which we won't, we see that forgiveness is a significant attribute in the character of God in Exodus chapter 34. So God can forgive us, but God's forgiveness doesn't go back in time and erase the errors that we have made. I don't know if you caught that in between the beeping. I'll say it again. So God can forgive us, but God's forgiveness doesn't go back in time and erase those errors that we made. And God may not remove the consequences that inevitably flow from those sins. And so it is with Jehoshaphat. He had plowed foolishly into an alliance without seeking God's counsel. And though God obviously pardons him from chapter 19, right? Nevertheless, there are good things found in these. The consequences that would flow from his foolish decision was going to prove very serious. Now, we saw, go over to chapter 21, verse 6. I'll try to fly through these as well. In chapter 21, verse 6, we saw in our last class what happened to Jehoram when Jehoshaphat put him in the ungodly atmosphere of Jezebel's household. What happened to him? Well, he became just like them. That's a consequence of the mistake that Jehoshaphat made. 2 Chronicles 21, verse 6. Jehoram walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab. For he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of Yahweh. So his godless character is attributed directly to his godless wife. So Jehoram turns away from the truth. He introduces wrong doctrine and godlessness and sin to the throne of Judah. He walks in the way of the kings of Israel. And when Jehoram dies, and his son Ahaziah takes the throne, well, look at chapter 22. Because Athaliah's influence in Judah is alive and well. 2 Chronicles 22, verse 1 to 4. And Ahaziah's mother's name also was Athaliah, the daughter, that should be the granddaughter of Omri. In verse 3, Ahaziah also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. So first Athaliah is the godless wife. Now Athaliah is the godless counselor, and eventually she becomes the godless queen. Look at chapter 22 and verse 10. But when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the seed royal of the house of Judah, the Davidic line, the royal Davidic line. And God had promised David, you will always have someone to rule on your throne. Well, Athaliah does her best to put her foot down and stop God's plan from going on. But providence steps in here in verse 11. But Jehoshabeath, the daughter of the king, took young Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons that were slain, and put him and his nurse into a bedchamber. And she hid him, at the end of verse 11, from Athaliah, so that she slew him not. And then notice verse 12. And Joash was hid in the house of God 6 years, and Athaliah reigned over the land. So what's six? Six is the number of man, right? The number of the flesh. And for that number of years of the flesh, Athaliah reigned over Judah. Well, so what's the long-term result of Jehoshaphat's affinity? Well, it inaugurated a period where the offspring of Ahab and Jezebel ruled simultaneously in the northern kingdom and in the southern kingdom. So you have false religion ruling both kingdoms. And the royal line of Judah, the Davidic line, was almost snuffed out. So I guess the lesson for us is be careful with what we do, because we have to use spiritual foresight to see where things can go. Because Jehoshaphat made what looked like just a single move, but there was a succession of steps that flowed from that, which were quite dire. Now, as we said in our last class, it wasn't wrong for Jehoshaphat to want to reunite the northern and the southern tribes. It had only been 60 years since Solomon had ruled the United Kingdom, and Jehoshaphat wanted desperately to sew this tear together. And his motives were good. Remember, we saw a couple slides back, verse 1 of chapter 19. His motives were, like, when Jehu comes, he says, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate Yahweh?" His motives were to help and to love. He definitely had the right motives. But, brothers and sisters and young people, good motives are never a replacement for spiritual discernment. No matter how good our motives are, we need to be very careful that we're using spiritual foresight. So what's the summary of Jehoshaphat's errors? Jehoshaphat was driven more by his heart than his head. He elevated friendliness over like-mindedness. He formed his standards on Israel's terms. He went to Samaria, worked on Samaria's terms, and we saw what came out of that. Jehoshaphat pledges allegiance and unity with Israel before he goes to God, without God's blessing. And his union is built on a compromise of God's truth, because he ignored some serious errors in doctrine and practice, didn't he? Ahab is worshiping a different God at the very time that he's saying he's calling on Yahweh. Well, what's the proof that his method was wrong? Well, the results speak for themselves. By your fruits you shall know them. Well, Jehoshaphat almost loses his life. In chapter 19, verse 1, we saw he's soundly rebuked by God via Jehu the seer. His son and his grandson walk in the ways of the kings of Israel. They're lost following the ways of Ahab. And the wrong doctrine and practice of Israel find their way into Judah by the influence of Athaliah, who has an influence on those three kings at least, and then herself, also ruling for 6 years. So I think that's proof that Jehoshaphat did not do the right thing. We want to avoid that root of action in the decisions of our lives, personally and ecclesially. But I think one warning we can take from chapters 18 to 19 is the danger of forming Ahab-like influences in our own lives. And we shouldn't be surprised that living in the last days, as we know we are, there's going to be significant pressure to unite ourselves with worldliness in whatever form, through our friendships, our relationships, our pastimes, our hobbies, our interests, things like that. In the last days, perilous times shall come. That's what Timothy tells us. Now, way back in Genesis 3:15, God said he was going to put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, between those who are committed to following God's ways and those who are committed to following the ways of the flesh, the earth. And enmity basically means war, right? So there's supposed to be war between us and the world and sin. But sometimes we take the approach that Jehoshaphat did in chapter 18, and we flirt with sin. And just like Ahab or Jehoshaphat made peace with Ahab, we can kind of try to make peace with the world so we can have the best of two worlds, as it were. And we underestimate its power. Now, about 50 or 60 years ago, or so I'm told, because I'm not quite there yet, I'm told you'd probably agree with your neighbor, for the most part, on a lot of issues of daily life. Respect for parents. Boundaries within relationships. The sanctity of marriage. Modesty. Language and behavior and respect and things like that. Because the Bible did, to a large degree, still have an effect, and it had some respect in North American society. But our society's standards of what's acceptable today have dropped significantly, haven't they? What's acceptable in today's society in regards to entertainment, in regard to reality, in terms of music, in terms of television, movies, entertainment in general, and the behaviors of our lives are far different. Even when I was a teenager growing up in the 90s, the bar has dropped. We need to make sure that we don't follow that bar down. Because as we await Christ's return, if we continue to uphold God's standards, then there should be a difference, a clear, significant difference between us and the world. And it should only become clearer. Some of you might have seen this illustration before. There should be a greater and greater difference between us and the world. If we're holding God's standard high and the world continues to go down, well, it should look something like this. And we are here. There should be a huge difference between us and the world. We shouldn't be satisfied just to say 4 or 5 notches above the world standard, because then we're still sinking at the same rate. In some ways, we have lower standards than even the world might have had. So we should stick out even more and more, and that means being more and more uncomfortable, doesn't it? But we want to have God's standard as the bar that we live our lives by. So, with regard to this idea of Jezebel-like influences in our lives today, well, how do we identify that? What does an Ahab-like influence look like? What does the Ahab-Jezebel spirit look like today in the world and in our lives? If Ahab and Jezebel lived today, how would I go about finding what they stood for? What their hobbies were? Who they admired? What they did with their free time? What their beliefs were? what I think, you go to Facebook. So Ahab and Jezebel, type it in. I was going to, but I didn't, to search and see if they had some kind of website, web, Facebook site out there. And I want to say before I do this, I'm not saying that Facebook is a bad thing to have. I'm just saying we have to be careful the way we use it. So I think you could find all the information if they live today by being their friend, if you wanted to. I hope you wouldn't, on Facebook. So let's think for a minute, without dwelling too much on the particulars, because we don't want to get too much in our minds. What would Ahab and Jezebel's Facebook site look like? And remember, we're trying to build a picture of them by the way that they advertise themselves. So, what kind of pictures and pastimes would they be advertising on their Facebook site? What kind of music would Ahab and Jezebel listen to? What about movies and TV? Who would be their idols? What would be their idols? But who? What kind of posts and discussion and subject matter would be on there? What other sites and links would they be advertising to? And without going into it, you can all build it in your head. I think the world would have its stamp all over their site, wouldn't it? And what do you think Ahab would have typed into that little box on his profile page about religion? Well, he would have said Christadelphian. God was still working with him. Elisha was still involved with him. But would the rest of his Facebook site be consistent with that claim? It's kind of like wearing a Christadelphian t-shirt, and I've seen a lot of them last night, and a lot of people have them. And it's a wonderful thing to do, to have Christadelphian on your shirt and have God's word on your back. But when we do that, when we advertise Christ, Adelphian, when we wear God's word, we have a responsibility to live up to it. I think Brother Tim was mentioning a little bit of that in the readings last night. I'm saying I am a follower of Christ, but am I living up to that claim? And I have a lot of Bible shirts too, and I need to ask myself that every time I put one on. So I have to ask myself, would Jesus click the like button on my Facebook site? Okay? And I can have 1,000 Facebook friends, and I don't, but I could. But if Jesus Christ isn't one of them, then we're in trouble. So when you think of it like that. And again, I'm not saying that having a Facebook account is equivalent to making an alliance with Ahab and Jezebel. But I just want us to think for a bit. I do think the way we advertise ourselves is important. What do we take pleasure in? What kind of things do we do? And what kind of things are we encouraging others to do? Because I have children. They don't know really how to use a computer yet, but I would be very, very, I'd very much like it for them to have Christ advertised. So, I don't know what it's like out here, but we're not losing young people to things like the Trinity or the immortal soul or wrong doctrine. At least when I grew up, the people in my Sunday school in CYC were lost to the spirit of Ahab and Jezebel that was trying to enter into the ecclesias, and it was successful. So, it's a question that bears thinking about. What are the Ahab like influences in our life, in my life, in your life, that we need to break away from? Now, in our first class, we saw that Jehoshaphat, we contrasted that idea of Jehoshaphat sought not to Balaam, but he sought to the Lord God of Israel. And we noted that you can't just point out all these things that you shouldn't be doing. We have to think of things that we should be doing and filling our life, crowding out these things so there's no room in our lives. So there's a little chart that we have in our notes, and all of us have Ahab and Jezebel spirit working in our lives to some degree. I certainly know that I do. And the chart breaks down the 168 hours that are in each week. And if you're anything like me, you don't do a really good job of using those hours. And, you know, one verse that really just makes me shake sometimes is in Ephesians when it talks about redeeming the time because the days are evil, and how do I really spend my time? Because we can be like Jehoshaphat and not do all the bad things that Jezebel did, but if we're not doing good things. So the chart makes allowances for time, you know, sleeping, working, traveling, meals and meetings and all that kind of stuff. And after all that's taken care of, how many hours are left in a week? And it depends if you have 5-minute showers or you have 45-minute showers, you know. It's going to be a little bit different numbers for everybody. So I left. If you don't shower, I mean, you can fill in the numbers yourself, right? But after all that, how much time is left and how much does God get? How much time does God get in prayer? In meditation, which I think is sorely overlooked, the idea of meditating, in Bible study, Bible readings, in serving our brothers and sisters. So we've got a few minutes to get started on this. And that's your participation in this. You all do have a chart, right? Just jot some ideas down, and I'm going to let you all do that. And just for a couple minutes to get started, it's just probably, if your math is as bad as mine, it would probably take you a long time to figure out all the numbers. So get some ideas down, and then we'll move on. And this is something for us all to think about when we go home. I think it's probably enough time to get some ideas down anyway. And even if it isn't, we only have 15 minutes left, so it's a good start anyway. So we're going to go back to chapter 19 then. And see that after Jehoshaphat accepts God's rebuke, he moves back to Jerusalem, he makes the necessary changes so he can again be with the Lord, so the Lord will be with him. And I think it starts with verse 4. So if we're all there, 2 Chronicles 19, verse 4. Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem. And dwelt is actually the same word as, it's the Hebrew word yeshab. The same word back in chapter 18, verse 9, where it said, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat sat, either one, on his throne in the gate of Samaria. So we saw that sitting represents fellowship. So in chapter 18, Jehoshaphat sat with Ahab. And then chapter 19, verse 4, it says, Jehoshaphat dwelt or sat at Jerusalem. So his feet are back in the place where he needs to be, grounded in Jerusalem. And then look what he does in verse 5. He sets judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city. And he says to the judges, take heed what you do, for you judge not for man, but for Yahweh who is with you in the judgment. And does that remind anybody else of what Micaiah said in the previous chapter? Micaiah had said, what my God says, that will I speak. And Jehoshaphat goes to his judges and he says, you judge for God. He's going to be with you in the judgment. So it's really important that you remember that. So Jehoshaphat's learning. He learned from Micaiah's words. Now we didn't go through this, but the word Jehoshaphat means Yahweh judges, or Yahashaphat. And Shaphat is means a judge. And Jehah or Yah means, well, it's God's name. So Jehoshaphat means judgment of Yahweh. And in verse 6, that's what he says. He says, you judge not for man, but you judge for Yahweh. Well, that's the meaning of his name right there. You judge for God. It's God's judgment. And don't go back there, but you can make note of this reference if you want. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. In Deuteronomy 16, verse 18, the kings were commanded to set up judges in all the cities to ensure that true judgment was executed no matter who you were. You could go to these judges and God's judgment would be upheld. That's Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. And that's what Jehoshaphat does here. He's going back to Deuteronomy and starting to put things back in place like they were in chapter 17. And he ends the rest of the chapter, which we're not going to go through, is his instructions to those judges. And he ends with a little phrase in verse 11, which I think is really, really neat. And the final note of encouragement he gives in verse 11 is, deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good. Or in other words, have the courage to do what is right. And I think that is probably the final lesson you learn from Micaiah, because Jehoshaphat didn't have the courage to stand up and do what's right. Micaiah did. And so the lesson is, stand up for what's right. You may get thrown into prison for it, like Micaiah did, but God's going to be with you. And that's a lesson. Now, we're just kind of squeezing this next section in here because we didn't have room in any other classes, but the name Jehoshaphat comes up in one other significant place outside of the Kings and Chronicles account in the Bible, and that's in the prophecy of Joel. So head over to Joel chapter 3. And Joel chapter 3 is describing what we know as the Battle of Armageddon. So we're just going to read through a couple verses there where the word Jehoshaphat comes up. Hosea, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos. Joel chapter 3. So, Joel chapter 3, verse 1, describing Armageddon. Joel 3, verse 1. For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather also all nations, and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And look at verse 12. Let the heathen be weakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. And you might be asking the question and thinking, the word Jehoshaphat doesn't even come up in this chapter, so why are we applying it to Joel 3's battle in Armageddon at the last days? Well, the word Armageddon only comes up in one place in the Bible. Does anyone know where that reference is? Revelation what? 16. Verse? 16. Revelation 16, 16. So let's go there. Revelation 16, verse 16. Okay, we're going to start at verse 15, actually. Revelation 16, verse 15. See if you can figure out... Well, let's just read it. Revelation 16, verse 15. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. We're just going to do a little exercise for the last part of the class to piece together some features, some words, some images, some themes related to this idea of Armageddon. We're going to start here. So, and I think you have all the answers in your notes. So at some point, I'm probably going to ask you to close your book so that it doesn't kind of take the punchline. But anyway, Armageddon. It said that they were gathered together in the place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. So that's kind of our hint. How are we going to interpret what this means? Well, in Hebrew. So we're going to break it into the three kind of compound Hebrew words. We have Arma, which means a heap of sheaves. If you go to, don't go there, but Ruth chapter 3 verse 7, speaking of Boaz lying down, and he lay down by a heap of corn, or a heap of, so the idea of a heap of some kind of grain product. Ge means valley. Think of Gehenna, right? Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. And Dan, or Dan, which is my name, means judgment. Daniel means judgment of God. But just Dan by itself is judgment. So putting this together a little bit, you get some of the key facts from Revelation 16:16, just 15 and 16, oops. Well, the timing is the return of Christ, because Jesus says in verse 15, behold, I come as a thief. So people need to be watching. So the timing, the return of Christ. There's reference to, in verse 16, a gathering. He gathers them, whoever them is, together. So there's a gathering. There's harvest analogy, a heap of sheaves, something to do with wheat. We're going to see the idea of threshing come up. And then it occurs in a valley. And it's some sort of judgment. So Armageddon, return of Christ, gathering, harvest in a valley for judgment. Let's go back to Joel chapter 3 and see. This is when I don't want you to look ahead in your notes, all right? See if any of the language or imagery is used, and we're going to find that it is. So don't look ahead in your notes, and I'm going to actually, Brother Paul Jackson, to read this for me. I did ask him ahead of time. Save my voice a bit.
So we're reading Joel chapter 3, verses 1 to 2, and then picking up at verse 9 to 16. For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations, and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. The Lord also shall roar out of Zion, and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth shall shake, for the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel.
So, thanks, Paul. First of all, how can we tell that this passage is then speaking of Armageddon, even though it doesn't say it? So without looking in your notes, I guess you could, but is there a reference to a gathering, some kind of gathering in these verses? And you can just, if you find it, call it out, and hopefully I have it too. Verse 2, it says, all nations, right? Okay. Anyone else? Okay, verse 14, it says, multitudes, multitudes. Verse 11, Josh? Verse 11, he says, assemble and gather yourselves together. And also, I think verse 9, it talks about, you know, the Gentiles coming together. Okay, so definitely language of a gathering. Okay, harvest language or harvest imagery. Is that found anywhere in this passage? Verse 13, put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Yep. Changing the pruning hooks and whatnot. Yep. There's actually one in verse 14 where it says, multitudes, multitudes in a valley of decision. In the authorized margin, it has concision or threshing. So if you ever see the word concision or decision, it's typically meaning a threshing floor or the valley of threshing. Actually, ironically enough, in that verse in chapter 19 we looked at where it said, you know, Jehoshaphat and Ahab sat in a void place. That word void place is actually threshing floor. So it's kind of interesting how it comes up again. Yeah. Okay, so what about valley? Verse 2. Verse 14. Verse 12. We got them all. Valley of Jehoshaphat, valley of decision. I think that's all. Anyway, judgment. Two. Hey, which word is that? Sorry. I should say that authorized version doesn't, King James doesn't have that, but I think it's in the King James, it says they will plead with them. And I think, yeah, that's the word Shaphat, actually. That's the word Shaphat. So, okay, thank you. Verse 12. Yep. in verse 12, it is this the name Jehoshaphat too, right? The Valley of Yahweh's Judgment. And he says, I will sit to judge the heathen round about. And I think that's what I had anyway. What about the timing? Is the timing similar to the idea of around the return of Christ? And the context of Revelation 16 is kind of from French Revolution on, so it's the 1800s, 1900s, and things like that in the 2000s, last couple hundred years. So, what about verse 14? The day of the Lord. You know, verse 1 and 2, it talks about when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, thinking of 1948, 1967, and the days of the regathering of Israel, kind of setting the scene, that's for sure. And we saw that there was a Hebrew or Israeli connection, right? The place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. So is there a Hebrew-Israel connection to this battle in Joel 3? There is. Can anyone see it? Verse 1, yep. He's going to bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. So that's setting the context. Verse 2, he's going to plead or judge for his heritage Israel. Sorry? Yeah, that's the last one I had as well. 16, God's going to roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is his home base. So although the word Armageddon itself doesn't show up in Joel chapter 3, the language of latter-day prophecy is consistent. It's the time of the end, Israel is invaded by enemy nations, and then they are saved by God's intervention. And it's found in a number of other passages and contexts throughout the Old Testament, both in prophecy, the prophesying of it, and also in type, you know, stories and examples which point forward to it. We're not going to go through it, you have it in your notes, but passages like Ezekiel 38, Daniel 11, Daniel 2 as well, Zechariah 14, Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, they all have components of this Armageddon language or imagery. So these are the type of verses you hear used at public lectures about what will happen at the time of the end, Russia and Gog and whatnot. And besides the examples we have up here, there's also biblical accounts that serve as types. So Genesis chapter 14, when Abraham goes out against the two opposing armies to rescue Lot. Well, do you know what the leader of the one army is called? It's Chedorlaomer. Does anyone know what that means? It means a handful of sheaves. So there's a harvest imagery. It happens in a place called Hazazon Tamar, which is something that's going to come up later on. So anyway, Genesis 14 and Judges chapter 7 and Gideon's battle against the Midianites. That's also a type. And relevant to our study, 2 Chronicles chapter 20, which we are going to be looking at tomorrow. But we didn't have time for the material tomorrow, so we shoved this little Armageddon part in here. But after we've looked at chapter 20 tomorrow, you'll be able to recognize how there's so much in the chapter that points forward to Armageddon. The very fact that it happens, Jehoshaphat is involved. So you have armies coming against Israel. This also happens in Hazazon Tamar, which is where Abraham's Armageddon battle took place. The judgment of Yahweh and Jehoshaphat, God intervenes and fights for his people. He delivers Israel, and the enemies of Israel are destroyed. So that's kind of a whirlwind trip of 2 Chronicles 20. As I said, you have all the references on the screen. Hopefully that's useful. I think it's quite interesting, but time does not permit us to go into it further. So we're just a couple of minutes over, so we're going to wrap it up then, as we are wont to do with lessons from chapter 19. God can forgive us for our errors, but he may not spare us from their consequences. We saw in Jehoshaphat's response that the way we handle rebuke is often a reflection of our spiritual character. And if we align ourselves with the Ahab-like influences of the world, well, the consequences can be dire, as they were for Jehoshaphat's family and for the whole Judah. We judge for Yahweh, Jehoshaphat, not for man. Judgment needs to be without partiality, without respect of persons, just like the judges Jehoshaphat set up. And we need to be fearless in our stand for the truth, like Micaiah, both in and out of the ecclesia, and God will be with us if we have the courage to do what's right. And tomorrow, we're going to be looking at that battle of chapter 20 that we referenced, and we're going to be looking at the very unique way by which Judah is saved. So, thank you.